Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
Back in the days when people said they raised their dogs like one of the kids, they meant this literally. Only the most deluded people would define themselves or their dogs as perfect, always devoted, reliable, and obedient, let alone willing to die for them. Nor would they define their parenting style as all positive either. Most parents aspired to be all positive, just as most little kids and dogs aspired to please those adults all the time, too. But in their own species-specific ways, most humans and dogs figured out that all positive was the stuff of fairy tales, something usually limited to the end of the story, when somehow, despite all the mistakes that were made, everything turns out all right. Sometimes real life does work like that, but it's not guaranteed. Some days dog owners are better than others. Some days their dogs are too, just like parents and their kids. In that world, mutual trust serves as the glue that holds the quality relationships together. Over time, though, trust as a fundamental element of a quality human-canine bond gave way to a canine obedience-centered model that redefined trust as a byproduct of the dog's obedience. If the dog obeyed, then the owner would trust the dog. Over the years, a human-centered, human-canine distance-creating progression evolved. It can be summed up with the letters TPDE. T referred to treats, which were equated with all positive. Where this originated is unclear. It's also unclear whether the recipient of the all positive experience referred to the dog or the person. However, few disputed that gaining a dog's obedience using treats was an incredibly energy-efficient human approach. For those folks willing to also place a strong positive emotional charge on their treats, it also could be a lot of fun, when it worked. When it didn't, which it may not for multiple legitimate reasons, often the treats were blamed. They weren't yummy or high value enough. This led to a search for better treats which, because of the link between palatability and fat content, often meant those with more calories. Simultaneously, the number of overweight and obese dogs also grew. But only a few dog owners, trainers, or veterinarians wanted to consider a possible connection. How could we get dogs to like people, let alone behave, if those people couldn't use treats? When treat training didn't work for some reason, treats often gave way to P, as in P for punishment. However, the forms of canine punishment had no parallels in what most people would consider a loving human family environment. One form of punishment recommended starving dogs so they would be hungry enough to obey for food. This was wrong on so many levels, it's difficult to know where to begin. One is something those familiar with dogs intuitively recognized that science later proved. The brain uses a great deal of energy, approximately 20 to 25% of the body's total supply. Like hungry people, hungry dogs have trouble learning. They're more likely to seek the easy way out. Like displaying the established problem behavior, instead of the desired new one. If starving dogs didn't work, more obvious to humans, forms of punishment were used. But perhaps because people felt safer or simply became conditioned to the distance between themselves and their dogs created by treat training, they perceived remote electronic punishment as more acceptable than whapping the dog with a rolled-up newspaper. Some even perceived it as positive because it didn't directly connect them to any discomfort the dog experienced. As far as what a shock or an audible tone out of nowhere communicates to a dog, it depends on the behavioral and bond context as usual. What preceded the behavior, the perceived problem behavior itself, the responses of others, human and animal, in the environment, and how this altered the human-animal relationship. Does it build greater trust between the person and the dog? It might or it might not. It might if the discomfort caused by the device causes the dog to stop displaying the behavior that irked or frightened the owner. And if that, in turn, causes the irked or frightened owner to calm down, then this may calm the dog. If so, this mutual human-canine calmness might lay the groundwork for mutual trust. However, it might not if some invisible electronic demon startles a dog in protective mode that generates a canine mind-body conflict. In this case, this may cause worse behavior or stress-related medical problems. Those who use electronic devices often do so because these enable them to separate themselves from their dog's physical and mental discomfort. They fail to appreciate the negative bond effects their physical absence may have on their stressed and confused animals at these times. It's one thing to know who's punishing you and why. It's quite another to be punished by an unknown source for doing something that makes sense to you and your person isn't there to help you. But regardless of its form, punishment tends to be a dead end. Once our dogs misbehave, the most we can do is stop the behavior if it poses a danger to them or others. It's too late to teach them an acceptable response should those same circumstances arise again. Now, in addition to needing to do that, we must overcome any negative effects the remote punishment had on the dog's relationship with us. Moving on in the TPDE sequence that occurs when people don't trust their dogs, D stands for drugs. I put drugs after treatment and punishment primarily because pre-drug screening tests and the drugs may be expensive. Consequently, people tend to start with other less expensive options first. However, in today's pharmaceutically driven culture, drugging dogs with behavioral problems may be the first choice for those who can afford it. If drugs don't work, then for many people, there's only option E. Eliminate the dog from the household by one means or another. Give the dog away. Take the dog to a shelter. Conveniently lose the dog far away from home. Have the dog euthanized. In reality, other options better for dogs and their owners do exist. In all cases, a crucial first step for owners means moving beyond any fears about what the dog did or might have done and understand why the dog did it. It means learning to trust themselves and their ability to handle their dogs. It means shrinking the distance between them and their dog created by treats, electronic collars, mats, or fences, and replacing these with trust. Once lost, mutual trust isn't easy to regain, but it can be done. During my career, I've met many people whose love of and commitment to their dogs enabled them and their dogs to do exactly that.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.